Radio Lazaretto with your host, Igor Plett.
Hello, welcome to Radio Lazaretto. This is Ego Plum. And I took like a year break from this show. It's been a really busy time. I've been writing and writing, mostly working on the Cuphead show, writing a bunch of cues like this one right here. That's all you get. Just a little snippet from Carnival, the first episode that just came out on Netflix this Friday. Okay, this is going to be a really cool Radio Lazaretto. I'm going to do something I never did before. I'm going to have an actual interview or conversation, I suppose. This is going to be between me and Chris Madigan, the composer of the Cuphead game. So I'm going to dial him up right now in my cell, and let's see if we could talk to him about all things Cuphead. Chris.
Hey.
Hey, it's Ego.
Are you hearing me okay on your...
Yeah, totally. I hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, yeah.
Excellent.
Funny, I was like, oh, I'm going to do this interview. I'm going to get my mic set up and do like the... I always do them over the phone, and I'm like, I can do better quality than that. But,
you know, I've done the Zoom thing before, and I'm always a little nervous, like...
Yeah, no, that's fair. If this is easier, that's totally fine.
I've never done any interviews for my little radio show. So this is exciting.
Yeah, I mean the episodes, I've listened to all five of them that are up, and they're all just you.
Man, I have a lot of questions for you, but I guess what I should do is probably give you just a mini introduction. I'm assuming if someone's listening to this, they probably know who you are and who I am. But nevertheless, I am talking to Chris Madigan of the wildly popular Cuphead game, originally released in 2017, I guess, and
yes.
Over 6 million copies sold. Is that right, or is that more now? Probably.
I mean, it's probably more. I don't know when that number came out. I haven't heard the more recent number, but that was, I think that was a few years ago.
Yeah,
so
wow.
Probably sold more.
Wow.
I feel like that number was even before the it came out on the Switch. So.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so
they probably. I mean, I don't know that they have those numbers, but normally they do a big announcement when they hit a milestone. So.
Right. Right. So then, of course,
yeah.
in 2019, soundtrack release of your music from the game, which actually went to number one of the Billboard Jazz charts. I mean, how crazy is that?
Yeah, that was pretty wild. Yeah, yeah, that was they re-released the like a shorter soundtrack with more of the essential tracks.
Yeah,
two LPs instead of the original four.
The original one is what, like 3 hours of music or something?
It's almost 3 hours, yeah. The first one is four LPs. It's quite long.
Yeah, wow. I want to say, first of all, like, one of my favorite things to read about your music, like, especially if you go on YouTube, one of my favorite things is, like, kids saying, what is this music? What do you call this music? I love the idea of young people being turned on to 1930s-style jazz and not knowing what it is, but being curious about it. It's like... The only ever other time I've heard of this is like when Guitar Hero first came out and like young kids were being turned on to, I don't know, like Black Sabbath or some old metal or rock.
Yeah.
And like dad's walking by like, why are you listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd? Or, you know, it's just like, it's the same thing. for that alone, man, I'm just so grateful for everything you've done, because like you are serving a greater good if that's the way that young people are responding to the music.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, you know, initially when I was working on this, it was a very small game.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was just trying to like wrap my head around it and do the best job I could for the game and for Chad and Jared Molnauer, who are good friends of mine, who brought me on board.
Yeah.
And then when that, you know, there was that time around E3, the E3 conference in 2015, where the game was sort of featured in the Microsoft Indie Reel, and everyone was like, what is that game? And then there was kind of this, you know, buzz around the game from that point on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of when we realized, like, oh, you know, there is a real responsibility here to, like, to do this music as well as we can, because it is going to potentially reach a new audience.
Correct.
So that was always, you know, that kind of became like one of the main focuses too. Like it has to be good. It has to fit the game, but it also has to be done with you know, the respect and reverence that it deserves. So
yeah, yeah.
So I mean, if it's reaching people, that is excellent, and it's always nice to hear it.
For sure. I mean, so how did you get started in music, man? Like, where does all this come from?
I mean, if we're going to go way back, like, I originally wanted to be a rock drummer when I was a kid.
Okay, so that's the one of the first things we have in common, then. Both drummers.
Did you start on drums?
Yeah. I started just playing in, like, beautiful punk bands in L.A. That's what I was doing. So what rock bands were you listening to?
So you grew up in arguably a cooler place or more music-centered place than I did, which was, you know, small city Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, like, I didn't necessarily see a ton of live music or know many people who were also playing music, but, you know, we had a couple of tapes in the car growing up that, you know, always heard driving around, and one of them was Billy Joel's Greatest Hit.
Sure.
And, you know, I was a big Billy Joel fan when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I think we taped it off TV. It was the Live in Leningrad show that he did in 89 or 90.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the first time I sort of saw that group. And Liberty DeVito on drums was just, like, I kind of already wanted to be a drummer, but, like, he just looked like he was having so much fun.
Right, right.
And that's a great concert. And so I begged my mom. My mom was also a big fan. I don't think it took that much begging, but, you know, they were coming through to Saskatoon, which is about 2.5 hours from Regina.
Yeah.
On the Stormfront tour in, I think that was 1990. And I was like, oh, can we please go to see the show?
That's great.
You know, incredible. So
yeah.
Liberty DeVito. And then also there was, he had an incredible percussionist, Crystal Taylor Farrow. I think, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name right. And she also was like, incredible show, the showmanship. Just looked like she was having so much fun and sounded amazing. So, you know, I was kind of gravitated towards the rhythm instruments from that point on.
Right.
And, so kind of, you know, in high school, played in some bands and ended up playing in the concert band in high school as well, playing percussion.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, it kind of just from there, that was my start.
Did you ever have a Neil Peart phase? Because I went through that when I was in high school, you know, Rush.
Oh yeah, I think particularly in Canada.
Right, right. Yeah, that was really important to me,
definitely.
For sure. It was like, I learned to play side one of Moving Pictures, like junior year in high school. And that was like, we would just sit in the garage, like just trying to perfect that and never reaching perfection, you know. That was amazing.
Yeah, I didn't like obsess over Rush the way that a lot of people did.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, entering high school, my biggest drum influence would have been Jimmy Chamberlain.
Yeah,
with the Smashing Pumpkins.
Right. Oh, cool.
I definitely have stopped listening to them a long time ago, but he is still like a monster drummer and like super interesting, really unique style. And very musical, and so I've always liked his playing. I modeled myself arguably more after him. And he was very also jazz. He sort of had a bit of a big band background as well, so.
That's interesting. So this is a weird question.
Yeah.
How do you think a band like Smashing Pumpkins, I mean, if that was a band of your formative years, like, do you think that plays any role in what you do today?
There's probably you can draw a path somewhere there, but you know, I think it was just like after high school when I was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life.
Yeah.
I took a little bit of time off, and you know, everyone's like, you should you should go into music, because I would say it was something I was good at in high school. And I was like, well, that's, to me, it seemed like a really dumb career choice. Like, yeah. You know, into music. Like, what am I going to do in music? Like, I can't make a living doing that. And like, eventually I was just like, you know, I spent a couple of years bumming around and took a year of general courses at the university. And I was like, man, I hate all of this stuff. And, kind of just was like, you know, I need to at least give it a shot. So I ended up studying classical / orchestral percussion at the university, and I still played, you know, still kept up playing jazz and big band in the, the university big band, and still tried to play as much drum set as possible. Had a pretty cool band in the early 2000s there before I moved to Toronto. But that was that stuff's on YouTube, and it has hilariously small amount of views. But I can send you some of those tracks too. They're quite funny.
That was Botanic Panic from the Cuphead game. level where you fight the root pack. So back to what we were talking about. It's interesting what you're talking about, like the idea of trying to make a living in music. We are very lucky to be doing what we do right now, you know? But
absolutely.
I recently, a friend who's a teacher asked me to, you know, speak to like a bunch of students. And I was telling him before, like confidentially, I'm like, man, the truth is I wouldn't wish this life on anybody. It's so difficult. Like you either have to really, really want to do this. It's just so hard, you know, as you could imagine, as you know,
yeah.
I mean.
I'm very fortunate that I want a job in an orchestra, particularly in the city that I wanted to live in. But like, that's a very, if you're in the on the orchestral side of things, like there's not much work.
Right.
I had many, many years that were, you know, at or around or below the poverty line, you know, trying to scrape by.
Right.
And particularly in Toronto, it's a very expensive city. You really, I think, have to want it.
I spent all my 20s in a cubicle, you know, with a regular day job, just trying to make music happen. Mm-hmm. And it was so hard. I mean, and I even more limiting for me in the sense that, like, I feel like I'm wired just to do weird, strange cartoons. And somehow I got lucky enough to be able to find those jobs. And it's worked out. But yeah, it's not an easy road. So I'm so happy that you're out there doing this because it's so rare, you know, hearing this kind of music, this style put in such a popular game. And now with our, you know, with the cartoon, similarly, you know, I feel like I'm taking the reins on that side of things. And trying to do a similar thing as you are. So, man, it's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, what I've heard so far sounds fantastic. Like, I'm really looking forward to hearing the whole... I mean, I don't know when this will air, but...
Yeah, I think we'll probably wait till the show drops and then we could put this on there. So, you know, neither of us get in trouble for anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least I don't get in trouble. So let me see. What else I want to know? Okay, I want to know... So you got the Cuphead gig because you were friends with the Mollenhauers, is that right? You kind of grew up with them, or tell me the story.
I grew up on their couch.
Really?
I grew up on their couch playing video games. I met Chad, I think, in grade 4.
Yeah.
And Jared is a couple of years younger, so I kind of met him through Chad. And this game, I think they're still kind of shocked with how popular the game got, because they just wanted to make, you know, they grew up making board games. And like they were always kind of making games as well, and they played a ton of video games, obviously. And once the indie game sort of revolution happened, like, you know, in the late 2000s, I guess, when it sort of became possible to make your own game and actually get it published, you didn't have to like work for Nintendo or Sega or Sony and like, you know, publish on a big platform. That was kind of when they had always wanted to make a video game, but it was not really like a feasible thing you could do. And so that was when they were like, oh, well, now we have the opportunity to do this, so let's actually, like, just try it. They asked me to do it, probably because my understanding is I was basically one of the only musicians that they knew. I recall turning it down a couple of times, saying, like, you know, this is not my, like, I know jazz music, and I've studied, you know, big band drumming and whatnot, but, like, I'm not... you know, you guys could probably find somebody better, but I think they knew that, you know, we would have a good working relationship at the very least, so that's kind of how it came about. So they kind of just, like, kept bugging me about it, as I recall it anyways, and I was like, okay, let's, because the thing is, I'd also always wanted to write, and I'd done a bit of writing before, not much, but, like, it was, you know, it's something I always wanted to do, but it's, like, if you've never done it before, it's kind of scary, like, that first step.
For sure.
And like, where do you start learning how to do that? And I'd written some, you know, pretty weirdo, like, process marimba pieces. And I wrote like, a pretty complex jazz piece for one of my recitals.
Yeah, yeah.
But other than that, like, I hadn't really written much. So it was, like, a huge learning curve. But it was the same for them. Like, they had to learn making a game from scratch as well. So it was, we were kind of all on a journey together in that respect.
I love the fact that the way you describe it, like, you were clearly outside of your comfort zone doing this, because I really think that we do our best work when we're just sort of uncertain. I describe it like floating in the middle of the pool away from the edges, like where we don't know, there's nothing to hold on to. So that's exciting to me. I had never done jazz before, but I welcomed the opportunity. Like, I really wanted this gig and felt like the fact that I hadn't done it is why I wanted to do it, you know? And I love stories like yours because similarly, like Danny Elfman, when he got his first scoring gig on Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know, he turned it down as well. Tim Burton and Paul Rubens wanted him to do the score, and he's like, I'm going to ruin your film. You don't want me to do this. But they convinced him to do it, you know, his first proper score, and now we have Danny Elfman the way we all know him. So it's always important to do those things. Like I said, step outside your comfort zone and take a chance like this. So, and you did it.
I mean, it certainly keeps it, you know, interesting too, if it's something that you've not done before, unless you're trying to do something like, you know, if you're being asked to write in the same style and sound like yourself all the time, like that must also be at a certain point, must be kind of like, okay, well, you know, a little, it'd be nice to step out of that. So, and I definitely tried to do that on the DLC too. Like all of these ideas that I had, definitely I wanted to go for a more early Hollywood, early Disney orchestral vibe for that. And that was stepping way outside of my comfort zone because that wasn't something that I had done for the first game. So, and it was very interesting to sort of try and work within that style.
I heard this really beautiful track you did on YouTube, the very sweeping Disney-esque orchestrated thing. You even have a triangle player that's featured, and I love that. And
that's me.
That was you?
Yeah.
I love that the camera cuts to the single triangle hit. That's your contribution. Fantastic.
I think that was my request, if you show me playing
triangle. I want to play these a couple of tracks that you sent me. First one being the Blue Fairy music from Walt Disney's Pinocchio from 1940. Let's go ahead and hear this.
Thank you.
Okay, that was the Blue Fairy music from Pinocchio. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, why is that song important to you?
I mean, I thought it was really neat just because that was the first, you know, they had this brand new, based on what I've been reading anyways, they had this brand new instrument in the studio called the Novachord, which was early Hammond organ. And I think that's kind of the first time that that instrument had been used, at least in a, you know, film context.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of, you know, again, like, I don't want to give away too much of, like, some of the stuff we're doing and some of the different groups of players we have, but, you know, I was like, okay, well, since it's time-wise makes sense, in the, or era-wise, then we should probably have a Novachord, you know, sort of in tribute to the great early Disney soundtracks.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's very, as you heard, like, it's a very, it must have been at the time in particular, like, such a strange sound for people to hear. Like, it's very sort of otherworldly. And mm-hmm. the way that he integrates it into the orchestra, too, is quite beautiful. I think that was Frank Churchill.
Frank did this next
MPB
piece.
Harline, yeah.
Frank did this next piece we're going to hear, the overture from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs from 1937. So let's go ahead and listen to this one. And we're back with Chris Madigan. Tell me about this beautiful piece of music we just heard.
I mean, that to me is that early Disney sound. It's that early Hollywood sound.
Yeah.
I really liked, yeah, like Frank Churchill and Lee Harline were the two of the big early Disney composers. That, Pinocchio, as we heard, Bambi, I believe. Yeah, like those soundtracks, particularly to those early Disney films, are just so gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that... I just really liked that the soundtrack to that film in particular is really cool, and there's nice use of themes, and obviously a lot of those soundtracks are nice, but of the early Disney films, I think that's probably my favorite one.
Now that we've heard your inspiration, let's go ahead and listen to what you created for the DLC with a sneak preview of music.
Cuphead. Here's a single meal to help make Alice real. It's a delicious last course. For the delicious last course. For the delicious last course. Set your Gallus heart to make the wonder talk. For the delicious last course. Using recipes to get necessities. For the delicious last course. With the pink in the song, as long as nothing goes wrong. With that delicious last course.
You've done an amazing job in capturing that Disney-esque lush magic that they do. And of course, with that second half giving us what we've come to love and know from you and Cuphead. So that's really exciting. Great work on that, man. Fantastic.
Thank you, yeah.
I think people are going to be really excited to see and play this game and listen to it. Is there hope of another release of music? Is that something you could talk about, or is that something we don't know yet?
Well, we'll definitely be releasing the soundtrack with the game, for sure. It'll be, hopefully people like it.
Yeah.
See, it's, you know, kind of in a certain sense, it's similar to the first game. It carries on, but in another sense, it's quite different, and it's a lot more lush.
Yeah.
And that was sort of another challenge, too. Like, how to, you know, it's not a separate game. It's another island, but can we make this island still sound like it's part of the first set of islands?
Right.
But can it also be something uniquely its own?
Right.
And so, you know, I think the music is lusher. The big band on the first soundtrack was a smaller band, like four saxes, four trumpets, two bones. And this is a full size, four bones, five trumpets, five saxes.
Wow.
So the big bands are a bit
bigger,
a bit fuller sounding, and then all of the other players as well. So it's, you know, bigger sound. And this, it goes along with what they're doing. It's like the animation for this game. There are some sections of that game that have four times as much animation on screen as the first game. So I've been told.
Wow.
So, like, I think it's going to sound better, at least from a, you know, a lushness standpoint, but also, like, it looks unbelievable, and you know, I'm excited for people to get to see it and play it and hear it.
You are listening to Radio Lazaretto with your host, Ego Breath.
I want to take a moment to play some of the music that's inspired me on my journey into composing music for the Cuphead show. So let's start with this fun little track called Nuts About Mutts.
Thank you.
I'm curious how you treat the idea of sort of like trying to be true to these influences versus having an element of Chris Madigan and who you are as a composer in the scores. Like, do you see those are two things that are like at odds with each other, or do you see it as sort of just working harmoniously?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a good question.
Yeah, it's tough, right? I mean,
yeah.
In my case, it's, I feel like I have a voice that comes through in the scores for the show. I think I have sort of, I'm able to take these things, and I think the very fact that I'm just sort of unschooled means naturally it just comes out like out of a blender, like a meat grinder in a really weird way. So it sounds like jazz, but it's something's off about it. And that has a lot to do with sort of the range of influences that I have, because I could quite literally say that like some punk rock stuff or some avant-garde music has like played more of an influence than jazz in some of the cues for the show. And that may sound strange, but it actually makes sense to me. So yeah, it's a weird thing to try to balance, you know, being authentic versus what are our own voices as composers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, yeah, if you're trying to stick to a style that's not your style that you invented, then how do you? Yeah, it's, for me, it was just like I didn't ever try to like lift anything and use
yeah.
it. Like I was trying to like take really broad strokes and use those kind of things.
Right.
But they're, you know, they're very specific chord progressions. They're very specific phrase endings, like speaking of, you know, in ragtime.
Yeah.
So you're kind of, if you want to write in that style, you're stuck using those things. So how can you make those original? I think it's, a lot of it is really just being aware of that and, you know, changing things enough that it doesn't sound like so much like something else.
Right. See,
the
other challenges arise, like, if I'm working on an episode of the Cuphead show, and let's say I have a piece of music and, you know, we're trying to stay true to a certain style and use certain instrumentation. Let's say we have a melodic phrase that is going to resolve after 16 bars and everything sort of concludes and feels right because it's going to end at this point with this in this key and in this note. But director says, okay, well, 2 seconds before that happens, he's going to slam a door and look really scared. So the music has to do something else. All of a sudden, you have to sacrifice the integrity of the piece of music you were writing and realize that ultimately we're really trying to disturb the storytelling. And it's not so much about the piece of music anymore, you know? So it's harder with this sort of thing, because I'm always sort of at the mercy of the needs of the director and the show and the characters and the story. So it's like, it's harder to stay true to whatever it is we're trying to stay true to. I'm wondering if it's similar for scoring for games, or if you encounter anything like that when you're working at all.
You know, like, so every mock-up or thing that I would send, particularly to Chad, he was very, he'd give it a listen, and, you know, he plays some piano, and he's, you know, musically pretty with it, and he, you know, is able to sort of give his own, like, he has the scene in his head, or he has the boss in his head, or whatever.
Yeah.
So he's able to do a better job of being like, this is going to work with this section.
Right.
Maybe do something to mix that up. But I kind of have the luxury, in a sense, that I'm not writing to picture in as strict a style.
Mm, yeah.
And the thing about Cuphead, which is, I think, quite different than a lot of games, is that it doesn't really common way of composing for games now is to sort of have things layer and change on top of each other as you progress through the level or through whatever.
Yeah.
And so you're really thinking, it's like the sort of a lot more like 3D kind of chess scenario.
Hmm.
And for me, that never made sense. I wasn't entirely sure how we were going to do that, particularly, you know, with it'd be challenging, I think, with real instruments. And it really complicates things. So we just kind of decided that it was more important to hit the vibe of each section, each level, each boss, than to worry too much about, you know, hitting certain marks, which,
right,
you know, are always changing depending on how the person is playing. So, like, the music in Cuphead is very linear. Like, they're linear jazz tunes that go from the beginning, and then they go to the end. And in theory, they all have sections where they're very loopable. Like, you can just go back and get someone taking that long. But, like, I don't know if you played the game, but, like, every tune in that game is at least twice as long as it technically needs to be.
Right.
Because, you know, either the player has died on that part, or they've beat it. Like, it's, people usually don't get stuck not progressing
in that sense.
So, and we could have made those tunes a lot shorter, but I still wanted to write, like, you know, the correct length for a pop tune, quote unquote, is, you know, 3 to 4 minutes in that sense. And, like, trying to write a tune that goes somewhere in 2 minutes in that style seemed really quick. So we kind of just hit on the idea of, like, I'm just going to write normal, quote unquote, normal, like, big band tunes.
Yeah.
And we're just going to play them sort of start to finish. If it enhances the vibe of what's going on, then that's more important than trying to line things up, hit certain points, you know, layer on top of each other, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, I mean, I haven't done any scoring to picture or to any sort of games where you would have to be trying to, like, change things as the game progresses.
And that was another big inspiration for me, Mr. Leroy Shield, with a song called Little Dancing Girl. Chris, do you have one or two artists that you would consider your biggest inspiration for the work you've done on Cuphead?
I mean, the two big influences by far were Joplin, and then for the big band stuff, it was Duke Ellington.
Right.
And Ellington was just, his voice is so unique through every era. You can listen, I feel you can listen to, like, a couple of seconds of almost any Ellington tune and know that it's him, because it sounds so different. His use of instrumentation and, like, the combining voices and harmonies and dissonance, like, no one else was ever really doing it the way that Ellington was.
Right.
So he was someone who was a big influence for me, not just obviously because he's a great composer, but because he was pretty adventurous. And, you know, he was willing to try things and was always revamping tunes and making them, you know, more. He was, like, for his whole career, he was taking old tunes and putting them in whatever style would be considered a bit more modern. So he was never really stuck in a style. He was always moving forward within that style. So he was someone who I would definitely, if I needed some sort of influence, I would go to him just to draw, like, some sort of inspiration from.
If I had to pick one person similarly as an inspiration for the show, I would say maybe Raymond Scott. I'm sure you're familiar with Scott's work.
I'm quite familiar. He did, like, so many different styles too, like very unique in that respect.
Absolutely. I mean, he even went into electronic music into the early 60s. I don't know if you're familiar with that. He started experimenting with making his own electronic instruments and stuff. Really wild stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, his sort of...
Apparently a bit of a crotchety guy, I heard.
Yeah, I never got to meet him, but I met his widow. When I was a young guy, I sent her a CD of my music just because I was such a fan of Raymond when she was still alive. I guess at this point, 20 years ago, I sent her a CD. I never thought much about it. And then, like, 3 months later, I got a phone call. And it's Raymond Scott's widow, just saying, hey, I wanted to thank you for sending me that music. It was very nice. Like, I could hear the influence of my late husband. I was like speechless. I couldn't believe it. You know?
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, that was super, super cool. But yeah.
Yeah, my understanding was that he didn't like his music being used in those cartoons because he thought it cheapened it or something.
Yeah, I heard he didn't even know at first.
It wasn't what it was designed for.
Right, right. Meanwhile, it's so perfectly suited for cartoons. It's so playful and silly and insane. Like, what else could it have been for, you know? When you hear those songs like Powerhouse and Oil Gusher or Penguin, it's like, of course it's going to be in cartoons. His stuff was so visual. Like, he was writing music that was sort of like cinematic music that wasn't really meant for anything other than just the thing he was imagining, like a penguin walking in the snow or whatever. Yeah, his stuff has been great. Such a great like source of inspiration. In fact, let's hear some Raymond Scott right now. Man, I love that. Twilight in Turkey, as performed by my musical lord and savior, Raymond Scott, with his band, the Raymond Scott Quintet. I want to ask you a little bit about the process because, you know, I'm sure we do things very differently because of the two different mediums that we're in. In my case, I get a locked picture with, you know, let's say 11 minutes of a cartoon that's already timed out perfectly. And that's when I have a spotting session with the director and we sort of go through everything, figure out all the beats, where this is going to start and end, different feels. Is there a sort of a version of a locked picture in a game development? Like, how does that work on your end?
I mean, there are a couple parts in the DLC where it is somewhat locked. Like, I guess the title screen, there's a little cinematic that'll happen, which is locked to the music. And I guess, you know, the ending segments to an extent, but in general, I mean, because it's not story driven in that sense, there's not necessarily these cutscenes which are timed out.
Sure.
So it's kind of the same approach as to the bosses. Like, it was just trying to catch a vibe for something.
Right.
And a lot of it was, you know, Chad would say, like, this is what the scene is, or I would get pictures of the boss, and then I would just write stuff, and I would send them mock-ups and say, like, is this going to work? Or do you need me to time this to something? And in general, it's just, like, it's been fine. So I haven't really had to deal much with locking stuff to picture.
Great.
So
how much time?
Which I can imagine is a lot of, you know, like, a lot more back and forth than I've had to.
It gets crazy sometimes over here. How much time do you get to do this stuff?
Well, I mean, I started working on this in probably right after the first game came out in the fall of 2017.
Right.
So, I mean, the amount of time I have has been increased because the game has been delayed numerous times.
Right.
So I've always been working towards whatever the most current deadline is. And
yeah.
So, I mean, in the first, originally it was supposed to be like 2018 that it was supposed to come out. So I was like, okay, well, I got to it right after the first game came out because I knew we had a deadline. And I'm very thankful that it was delayed for numerous times because I was really able to flesh out a lot more ideas. And even the whole orchestral side of things, like, I knew I wanted that old Hollywood sound, and this would have been in the fall of 2020, I guess, like around September.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, I had a version of what you hear on the behind the scenes video, and it just didn't have that sort of splash opening, and it was just like a harp and then like a small string group, and I was just like, man, this is not, you know, it's not cutting it. Like, what am I? And I kind of sat with it for a long time, and I was just trying to figure out what it was missing. And then that was when I decided, like, okay, we have the time now. COVID has delayed everything again. And so that was when I kind of just decided, like, okay, what this really needs is that really lush, exciting old Hollywood kind of sound. And so then I just went down a rabbit hole of watching those films and checking out those scores. Only because I had the luxury of time to do so. If the game would have been coming out, then it would have been a different score.
I'm so glad you had that luxury of time because it sounds gorgeous. It's just so rich. Yeah, I mean, I heard that thing you sent me on YouTube is just amazing. And yeah, without having that open, you know, schedule, how else would we be able to do something that great?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate, I guess, too, in that they're also, it takes them a long time to make the game. You know, so it's, the art side of things is wild how long that takes, the way they're doing it, you know, hand drawing everything.
Yeah,
It kind of naturally gives me a certain amount more time.
We have this sort of really tight pipeline. You know, it gets all scheduled in a way where at a certain point, things got a little hairy during the pandemic. And there was some times where I had maybe 7 days to turn around one episode, which was almost near impossible for me because, besides composing and performing and then getting charts made, getting the musicians, which I couldn't get in my studio anymore because now we're in the middle of a pandemic and can't have, you know, horn players breathing on each other and spit valves everywhere. So people are recording remotely, then getting everything back and mixing and then notes. You know, it was touch and go for a second, but we got through it. And we're still doing it. I mean, today, after we're done talking, I'm going to get back to work on another episode. Right now I'm in the middle of a big chase scene with the devil. It's kind of fun. But I'm always up against the clock, having to every once in a while make compromises on, well, we can't get a clarinet and alto guy today. I'm just going to have to change it to something I could play here, but let's do it on the xylophone and some other instrument on guitar. You know, you sort of have to give and take to make things work. At the end of the day, we're all very happy with the way it's sounding, so that's good.
Yeah, I mean, particularly now, it's like, no matter anything you're making, it's like, what can we do under the circumstances?
Exactly.
And it's, so, I mean, one of the reasons we wanted to make that video, too, was just to be like, you hear this big sound, which you would do in one session on a concert stage somewhere, and now it's, you know, you have a 50-piece orchestra that's divided into groups of 10, basically.
Right.
It, that also really complicates things. It's very, you know, I'm extremely fortunate that the studio is willing to sort of support that kind of, these crazy ideas of let's record a huge orchestra in a pandemic.
man of mystery that's roaming through the land. Far and near you hear of him, he's found on every hand. Every city, town, and village knows of him by now. There's a way to recognize him, let me tell you how. Now if your path at midnight dark by a graveyard goes, and someone whistles, why that's Mysterious Bose. Or on some dark and stormy night while the tempest blows, if someone whistles, that's Mysterious Mose. He sees all, knows all, he gets in everywhere. Now some night, he might wait for you upon the stairs. So when you're going down the cellar, walk upon your toes. And if someone whistles, that's Mysterious Mose. Wakes from the sleep by the peep, peep, peep of a flute from down below. If someone whistles, why that's Mysterious Mose. Now if at dawn of an early morn a trumpet softly blows, if someone whistles, that's Mysterious Mose. He sees all, knows all, perhaps a clarinet or bass horn. Or anything that he can get. He plays on every instrument, but there's just one tune he knows. When someone whistles, that's Mysterious Mose.
Was Mysterious Mose from 1930 as performed by the Radio All-Star Novelty Band. As we wrap up our hour, I want to ask you about the future. I'm curious, how do you feel about, would you ever want to score like a feature or a series, or how do you feel about that? Or do you feel at home in games?
I mean, I think if the opportunity came my way, then I think it would be something that's interesting, but you know, I don't work particularly fast.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I don't consider composing my main job. Like, I'm still, you know, at least in normal times, like a fairly busy musician and freelancer in Toronto. So, sure. Like, that eats up a lot of time as well. Mm. And that's kind of what I consider my main thing. So I would like to do more composing, but I'm kind of waiting to see also what they want to do next. At the studio. And, you know, it'd be nice to work on another game with them once the DLC is out. I would love to be asked and then to maybe think about things, but taking on a huge, like, what you're doing is just, like, I can't fathom the amount of work that goes into that. So, like, kudos to that.
Thanks, man.
So, but, yeah, it's just, like, a time thing. Like, how much, there's only so much time in a day, so.
Right.
Taking on a film, you know, also the way that apparently films turn over, like, you know, you have 2 or 3 months to create a score. Like, that boggles my mind.
Yeah, it could be brutal.
I would love to do it. I'd be interested, but, you know, I'll cross that bridge if and when I'm offered something, I guess.
Okay. So at this point, you don't have anything to announce about the near or distant future as far as Chris Madigan projects outside of the DLC?
No, I am working on a very cool project, which is fairly secretive at the moment, but it should be neat when it comes out. And
we should probably talk. Let's talk again at that point.
The DLC at this point, too. Like, we're just doing the final mixes now, and so that's still a decent amount of work before we're ready to really get that out there too.
What is the date for the DLC again?
I believe it is June 30th of this year.
Great. So we have two things to look forward to. Cuphead Show, February, oh God, I don't even know the date. 19th? 19th, one of those.
16th?
Yeah. And then DLC, June 30th.
I should also double check that.
Neither of us know.
I'm pretty sure it's the 30th.
We're too busy working to keep up with these sort of things.
Yeah, as long as we're hitting our own deadlines, and that's what's important.
Right. And that hasn't been easy over here. Boy. It's rough.
Yeah, I can't. Man, if you're doing like 40-some shorts, that's wild.
Yeah, man. You know, it's like, I always wanted to be like, I wanted to be Carl Stalling as a kid. That was sort of my ambition, you know? And it's what's kind of cool is I am getting to do sort of Carl Stalling-esque type things. You know how he would always quote, you know, popular music of the day when he was scoring Looney Tunes. And in my case, I'm getting to, on occasion, quote Chris Madigan, sort of like little Easter eggs for, I think the audiences will appreciate that, sort of hearing little bits of what you've done, sort of weaved into my score. So that's kind of fun. I hope you'll like it too.
I think it's going to be fantastic.
Thanks, man.
I've heard bits and pieces, and obviously the trailer.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to check it out.
Dude, thank you for everything you've done. You've paved this path that now I'm a part of. I'm sort of happy to, I don't know, what would we call it? I'm sort of like, we're brothers in arms now on the Cuphead.
Yeah, I would say that.
Yeah. So, man, I'm so happy to be a part of this and really grateful. And thanks for everything you've done. Of course, you've been a big inspiration, too, for everything I've done. So that goes without saying.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah. And I can't wait to hear everything that's coming next.
Hopefully, if you're in Toronto, or I'll probably be in L.A. before that.
You got to come down to the studio.
That's a big thing. Oh, I know, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, we were down there for the original release in 2017, I guess.
Oh, so you've been here.
I've been there a couple times. But, yeah, the release for the game, we had a release party with everyone at Meltdown Comics.
Oh, that's great. I didn't even...
It was really cool. It was like, that was the first time a lot of us had actually met, because we're all so spread out over the globe. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll meet at some point, and we could hang out.
Definitely, hopefully.
Man, thanks for being part of the show. I'm so happy to talk to you finally. And I'll keep in touch, let you know how I'm doing, and we could talk again once everything comes out. I want to know about Secret Project. Let's talk after the DLC drops and my show drops, and, you know, we could compare notes, arm wrestle, anything.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, and with that, that is the end of our interview on Radio Lazaretto. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time. Thank you.
listening to Radio Lazaretto with your host,